Welcome to Unlikely Freedom Fighters, the podcast for anyone whose political landscape looks more and more like a dystopian nightmare. For all of the everyday Americans out there just trying to build community, restore common sense, while fighting what feels a lot like fascism. Before we begin, let's introduce your host of the podcast. Hello everyone, my name is Kaylee. I'm a mom of two living out in the rural foothills while also running for Congress.
Hi everyone, my name is Bijan and I'm Kaylee's campaign manager for this cycle. I'm a very proud Mainer, unabashedly Mainer, and I'll be your co-host. Kaylee, can we just take a step back and maybe explain to the audience why we started this podcast and maybe give some background into our endeavor here?
Of course. Sure, Bijan. As a college student and a working class mom of two, I ran for Congress back in 2022 in one of America's reddest districts against an election-denying far-right member of the Freedom Caucus, Russ Fulcher. As a rural progressive, I saw the reality of what divisive political theater and the immense power of far-right special interests we're doing to our communities, how extremism is destroying communities and robbing people of really good, sensible policy solutions. This podcast is for rural America. It's for forgotten districts like mine, and it's for every regular person out there who found themselves fighting for their rights, for their safety, and for their lives. For all the unlikely freedom fighters out there protecting the actual American dream.
I appreciate you, Kaylee. And that's super important for folks listening to know. And it's a story that is really common with a lot of folks out there. So it's great that we've got this sort of platform and are taking a pretty critical part, I think, in the conversation. So really appreciate that. But what are we going to be talking about today?
On today's episode, we'll be covering current events. We will play a new game called Time Warped. We'll respond to some of the comments from last episode. And most importantly, we are joined by the incomparable Teresa Borenpaul. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my friend Teresa. Dr. Teresa Borenpaul is running for Idaho's House District 3. She's an advocate for education and has dedicated her career to decreasing the barriers of education for Idaho's students. Teresa developed a region-wide education program to ensure that the students of North Idaho were able to seek higher education. In 1 year of the program, go-on rates increased by 25%, with rural schools seeing the greatest impact. Dr. Borenpaul has stood up against far-right actors, extremists, and provocateurs in her community, and Teresa will fight every day to ensure that Idaho students are prepared for the world that awaits them. Teresa, thank you so much for joining us today. It is so good to have you.
Thank you so much, Kaylee and Bijan. It is such a lovely time to spend with you tonight.
Wonderful. Well, we really appreciate you being here. It wouldn't be the Unlikely Freedom Fighters podcast if we didn't start with an icebreaker. Now, I know how much I'm sure you love these. So got a bunch of questions for you. Promise there won't be a quiz at the end of this, but let's just jump right in. I know that we're all super excited to find this out. So, okay, Teresa, you know, we all know how great you are, the impact that you're making in the state. I've had the chance to meet you in person, wish it would happen again. But if you had any superpower for the day, what would it be and why?
Ooh, only getting it for a day, that's a little tricky. But I do think it would be the power to fly. I love to go skiing, and getting to the top of the mountains really fast is worth it. So one day where I can just fly to the top and ski back down sounds like a blast.
I mean, I'm not gonna argue with that. I'm not gonna argue with that. I can think of probably four or five places that I would go right now. But okay, so let's say you were flying all day long. Surely you're gonna work up a hunger, right? Like you're going to end up, I'm sure you're going to be hungry by the end of your long flight. Your go-to comfort food?
My go-to comfort food would certainly be a Hudson's hamburger. If you have been to North Idaho, Coeur d'Alene specifically is the best burger on the planet.
Is that right? Okay. So Kaylee, next time we go to Coeur d'Alene, or next time I have the chance to be in Coeur d'Alene, you know, I've been there once and absolutely loved it. We're going to Hudson's next time. So Kaylee, when we go on the road again, I need that in my life. I need some Hudson's. Okay, awesome. Great. What is your guilty pleasure when it comes to TV, like TV shows, movies, content? could be TikTok, Instagram, whatever, maybe. What's your guilty pleasure?
But you feel comfortable sharing, of course. I do, because it's kind of nerdy. I'm a Jeopardy fan girl. I love Jeopardy. Seeing if I can get the answers to the questions up before anybody else in my household.
How long have you been watching Jeopardy?
I mean, we don't have cable, so since we haven't had cable, probably a decade.
That's awesome. Oh my God. Oh my goodness. Okay. All right, Kaylee, I think it's your turn.
Oh, thank you. I am going to move into what is our second segment of the day and what I call the scariest part of our podcast, which is where Bijan goes over some current events and we respond to what's happening around Idaho.
You know, if you come to know me long enough, you'll end up agreeing with that statement and that. The news with me is usually the scariest part first, so I'm super happy to own that. But in all seriousness, let's dive right in with some current events that are happening this week in Idaho. Guns in Idaho? Sure thing, says Rep. Ted Hill from Eagle, who introduced House Bill 415 this week, a bill that would allow teachers, staff, and volunteers to carry a gun in Idaho's public schools with an enhanced concealed carry permit. This happened, folks. The Idaho Education Association Board of Directors have expressed their concerns, rightfully so, because the one thing that we all want to see is teachers armed to the teeth, to quote the organization, provide an armed force to protect children. The IEA contends that firearms should be solely in the possession of state and local law enforcement officers who have received the proper training and authorization from the school board. The bill passed in the House and is on its way to the Senate. So, I guess the question for both of you is, what's going on here? Brad Little was up in Post Falls earlier this week talking to some students, many of whom happen to be in trade programs. And even he was saying to those students in a roundtable discussion, I have a problem with folks walking in with a concealed carry permit into our public schools. So we're now living in a time when teachers are being asked to be therapists, best friends, Navy SEALs, co-parents. Kaylee, Teresa, what's going on here?
Well, Post Falls is
Teresa,
where I live.
Teresa, as an educator.
Yeah, and I live in Post Falls.
You should take this one.
Well, you can look at this from so many different levels, right? When we introduce guns into situations, more and more guns, we actually increase the amount of danger. Because if there is an incident at one of our schools, God forbid, and we have a bunch of vigilante weapon holders, well, then we don't know who the bad guy is and who the good guy is, and we really muddle the scene for our local police officers. And actually, there was a fantastic letter to the editor recently in our local newspaper from a police officer that said this exactly, that when they get on the scene, they need to know who their target is, so that way they can keep our students safe. And you add more guns, you add more mystery to solving that quickly.
And it's really frustrating because we keep watching Idaho legislators kind of continue this myth that more guns equals more safety. And the data, every ounce of information that's been collected over the last 50 years argues against that fact. And I know as a parent, it's really frustrating because I think of how overwhelmed my school systems are. I think of how many children are in each class. We have, 32 to 36 children in a classroom. We have trouble finding teachers, finding substitutes, and now we want to add more firearms into this equation. And wasn't it just this year also that Idaho tried to lower the standards and certifications that teachers needed to teach in schools because we were having such difficulty finding teachers in the first place? And so now we want to add firearms into those equation, and it just doesn't make any sense. And we're basically gambling with the lives of our children. And I know for me, that's terrifying. I want my children to feel safe. I want them to have an authority figure. I want them to have SROs. I want them to have protection, but I don't want that to be reckless abandon.
And Kaylee, like you said, as a parent, it's what you want, because at another level, this is infringing on local control, right? Like in Kootenai County alone, we have three separate school districts. One of our school districts, Lakeland School District, they actually use their levy dollars to hire armed guards for their schools. So from their perspective, they probably already have this taken care of. Whereas in Post Falls, we have SROs, but we don't have armed guards necessarily. And I actually like that my school district doesn't have armed guards, but it is nice for local entities to be able to say, this is what our community needs and this is how we can best protect ourselves, because we have a relationship with the police department. And when everything is known, when they come on site, they can do the best, the most good.
Exactly. And I think people often forget that legislatures' jobs are not just to think of a good idea and then create a law that sounds right to them. It's really about collecting all the pertinent information and making decisions, not only on a constitutional basis, but on a safety level. And I don't think anyone actually thought out the insurance and liability aspects of this. I know teachers and schools are stepping forward saying their insurance will drop them if they won armed teachers, but also the law, I believe, had it so that they could have volunteers with concealed carries without really any control for administration to be able to step in and stop just whatever randoms off the street from carrying. And so it's just on a practical level, not even just an emotional level, the law doesn't make sense.
Can I just ask, you know, Teresa, as an educator, you know, I grew up in Maine, and I remember very fondly being close to our school's police officer. His name was Officer Friendly. So Officer Friendly, if you happen to be listening to this, gosh, I remember you, my friend, and I will never forget your mustache, and I learned a lot from you. But Officer Friendly, and I use this anecdote because Officer Friendly was unarmed, but it was just a sort of in-school officer, you know, didn't really sort of present, you know, a threat to anybody, was in fact a friend to many of the students. Are there studies out there, I'm sure these exist, but you know, have you seen any sort of studies around like the presence of just a physical gun in the school and the effects on students' ability to learn in that environment? You know, sort of like a sustained exposure to guns inside of the classroom, has that translated to affecting how our students are learning, or how that's affected kids at a very young age?
Bijan, I actually haven't studied that that body of research, but I'll guarantee you, neither did the legislature when they looked at this.
And that's the point.
Exactly.
All right. So now we get to move into what is going to be my favorite segment of the podcast, which is our interview with, and I call you incomparable for a reason, Teresa, Dr. Borenpaul. It's because you have more energy than I'm pretty sure an entire county of Idaho has in the population. And you just do tireless work for the good of the community with absolutely really no resources. There's no fame or glory. You do the work that actually reaches into people's homes and makes a beautiful impact. So I can't wait to get started. I'm going to start this off with just a simple softball, which is, how do we save America?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Wow. How do we save America? From my personal perspective, we save America through education. And that's not just at the K-12 level. When people understand what's going on in their communities civically, they step up. They recognize when there is inequities, and they say, I want to be part of the solution. But our day-to-day lives are really hard and really full. And so it's hard to take a moment to learn about, you know, local politics, statewide politics.
Which is interesting, because I don't think I've learned this about you, which is, how did you first get started? How did you take that jump from being an educator to all of a sudden being really politically involved at the local level?
Well, politics came to my work. So I worked at North Idaho College, which is a community college in North Idaho, and it is picturesque. It's on the shores of Lake Coeur d'Alene, a two-year school with ivy on the buildings. It is simply stunning. And when we had an influx of individuals come into our state during COVID, a far-right group took over the board, and the school has been on the cusp of losing accreditation ever since. And I recognized that I could do more work from the outside than I could from the inside. So when I really got involved was when I took a step back from education and said, I'm going to be a community member who informs people about what's happening at North Idaho College and who gets involved in the elections and in the meetings.
And North Idaho College is actually in my district. And I still remember before I had ever traveled to North Idaho, I heard from several people, North Idaho College is the soul of Coeur d'Alene. It's the absolute gem of North Idaho. And I didn't fully understand until I went there for the first time. And I go to community college down in the Treasure Valley. And so I thought I had an assumption of what it would be like. But it really, you cannot separate Coeur d'Alene from North Idaho College. You drive through Coeur d'Alene and the campus is just kind of seamlessly interwoven. You have students both on campus and off. It really is the breathing, beating heart of Coeur d'Alene. So it doesn't surprise me at all that you would jump in to protect something as incredibly important as it is.
You're right.
I am curious because this is something we talk about a lot. What resources did you find were available? Because it's really difficult making that initial leap into local politics. I'm curious what was available to you or what was the experience like going from an educator to politically active?
It was tricky, especially with a D next to your name in North Idaho. That kind of is the scarlet letter as you enter conversations. The population in North Idaho that is a registered Democrat is very, very low. But we do have a really robust central committee. They have been supportive by volunteering and through donations. But as you know, Kaylee, being a Democrat in Idaho, it's really hard to solicit, you know, big donations. Sunshine reports are public, and it's such a dicey political atmosphere that that having your name associated with a partisan office or a partisan candidate can be hard. So I can say that I've been able to network a lot. I've been able to grow my skills and teach others so that they can help with not only my campaign, but other campaigns as well. But it's tricky. The resources are scarce, but the energy that people feel around seeing somebody like them on a ballot up here is pretty palpable.
There's definitely no shortcuts. And I try and explain to people what being a rural progressive is like. And it just means you have to work harder than anybody else to get just a fraction of kind of the resources and attention that other districts kind of take for granted. And it's interesting because you took that jump and it was because the board at North Idaho College had been taken over. And we hear the word extremism a lot. I mean, people throw around terms like white supremacists, Christian nationalists, anti-government militias. And for those who aren't directly affected, it can just kind of seem like another term that, you know, political operatives throw around, can feel like political theater. But I know for a fact, as you do, that's not the reality of what's happening in Coeur d'Alene. So I was wondering if you could take us into what extremism is in Coeur d'Alene, what your experience with that has been.
Yeah, I can do my best because you're right. It's such a different experience that when I talk to people that live outside of this space, it feels like I'm being hyperbolic, but we're not. I'll give you two examples that kind of bookend what it's like to live in North Idaho. So when I go to public meetings, the far right always have a cameraman that attends every single meeting. And the camera has a really sensitive microphone. And when that cameraman is there, he's not paying attention to what's happening at the front, at the dais where the meeting is happening. He's panning the crowd. He's cueing on people's conversations. He's focusing in on your cell phone and on your laptop computer. They're picking up information and creating this pool of information for themselves that is incredibly uncomfortable. I was at a meeting just yesterday and turned to a colleague of mine who's a reputable lawyer in town and just said something quick, and I turned around, the camera was on me recording. And so that's one bookend. Let me tell you the other extreme. A couple years ago in North Idaho, just like we do every year, we celebrated Pride in the Park, where we let everyone in our community know that it's Pride Month and there's so much to be celebrated around that. And my colleagues and I spent the month leading up to Pride in the Park erecting these huge banners that said, there's so much pride in freedom of speech. There's so much pride in freedom of expression. But Kaylee, we had to make those banners about 30 feet long and about 6 feet tall, because what we were trying to do with those banners was create a barrier between the celebration and militia groups that showed up with their long rifles to intimidate children who were celebrating in the park. That's the bookend.
It's devastating. North Idaho changed my life. And this is because I had heard about extremism. We all experienced the Trump administration. We knew what that was. But I still remember hearing about the Gun Delane event, which, for those who aren't familiar, there was after the scary BLM busloads were coming to North Idaho, which they weren't, a bunch of different militias came together and occupied downtown Coeur d'Alene. You had Proud Boys, you had 3%ers. For 5 days, they camped out on Sherman Avenue. Businesses shut their doors. People were afraid to go to work. So on the anniversary of that, they held their Gun Delane event, which is all of these kind of militia members and far right and panhandle patriots come together with their guns. So I had heard about this and I decided to go up and hold a press conference to call out these specific people, their specific associations with groups like Europa. But I hadn't experienced it firsthand. And I remember setting up for that press conference and seeing these truck envoys kind of running around the church of where we were setting up with giant actual white power flags out the back of the truck. I mean, you see trucks drive by with anti-Semitic bumper stickers, with hate group bumper stickers. And it was this idea of like, these people actually exist. They're trying to make their presence known and they are very aware of what we're doing here. And I was there as a visitor. I couldn't imagine what it must be like, especially for marginalized groups, especially for LGBTQIA groups, what it must be like living with that each and every day. And so for you as a local candidate, how does that impact? Can you tell us a little bit more about what it actually looks like when these far-right operatives infiltrate local government and how that impacts your community?
Yeah, well, when these operatives take over boards, it's happened a few times now, and we've also been able to prevent it from happening a few times, so we should chat about that too. But at North Idaho College, for example, or the Community Library Network, the local central committee of the Republican Party, the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee, they endorse candidates, and then they, I can't say for sure that they then control what the narrative is, but I can tell you that in every single board that the KCRCC has been able to take over, all three majority candidates will go in lockstep to change up whatever's happening on that board. So some of their favorite things to do are to try and fire the director or president of the organization. They'll take really drastic moves and hire new legal counsel, and the legal counsel will be on their side and will direct them accordingly. They will take actions that break open meeting laws. And as a result of all of those things, we'll also lose our insurance. We lose insurance, you become financially insolvent. And so it's this recipe that they've designed to whittle away at the integrity of our institutions, and it works. It drives team members away, and then there's a brain drain from the organization. I was part of that, unfortunately, right? I had to leave in order to really get involved because there's restrictions as an employee about how involved you can get. But then also there's all these negative stories then in the newspapers that say, you know, the college is overspending or the library can't make its payroll. And then that sows fear in the community as well. So it's watching these institutions just get whittled away and whittled away. Luckily, they haven't been successful in eliminating our college yet. If that ever happened, that would be devastating for this area. So to the end that they do it, I mean, it's to sow this discord in the community and to make you lose trust in public entities. But I can tell you that in North Idaho, we have a really strong contingency of people who have lived here their entire lives, who are fifth generation Idahoans, who know what it means to have a public library, who know what it means to have public schools, who know what it means to have an economic driver like North Idaho College in the middle of town. So we fight.
North Idaho is one of the most incredible communities up there. It's just the bond that we have. And even me as an outsider, when I get to go up there, the community is incredible. But it kind of highlights how important it is, because when we normally talk about politics in this country, especially those that are outside of the political system itself, people are talking about the president, they're talking about Congress, they're talking about these kind of higher level elections, which still don't have the greatest voter turnout. But what we see in the rural areas specifically is that our most vulnerable communities, the areas that we see being impacted the most, are usually local elections. It is school boards, library boards, city council, commissioners, all of these races that the vast majority of us are just not thinking about on a daily basis. And unfortunately, because we weren't thinking about it, they were vulnerable. And that's kind of where we see this fight start to take place. And you brought up a really good point, which is we've had some success. And so I would love for you to go into, okay, now that people are paying attention to these local races, what has worked in your community to try and kind of stop these far right elements or these kind of unserious candidates from coming in?
It's a really great question. I can tell you the unserious candidates are still coming in, but it's about informing people and beating them at the ballot box. So this past, when was it? They all run together, November. We had elections for school board, and Coeur d'Alene was in a really tenuous situation. So they had two individuals who were KCRCC endorsed by the local Republican Central Committee. And if they got one more person, they would have had a majority and they would have run Coeur d'Alene schools in the same way they're running North Idaho College. And that's what we did. We let people in Coeur d'Alene, voters for that school board race, recognize that if this happens, you will turn into North Idaho College. We told them about, you know, how they were spending money at NIC and how this will become you, how they have changed up the legal protections. This will be you, how, you know, people are quitting and leaving their jobs. This will be you. If you want Coeur d'Alene School District to look like North Idaho College, then vote for the KCRCC. But if you don't want that, and vote for these really smart candidates. And it's not that we were finding candidates on the absolute other end of the spectrum. These are normal, everyday people who have been involved in their churches and their community. They have kids in the school district, and they care deeply about the success of Coeur d'Alene schools. They recognize that it matters from their child all the way to our economic viability. And so that's what we did. We let people know who these candidates were and then let them know the antithesis. These other candidates will get you what North Idaho College has to offer.
I love that so much. And I was surprised to learn, because when I went up there, I learned if North Idaho College were to lose its accreditation, it was $60 million annually in the local economy and thousands of jobs. But most importantly was the impact it was going to have on rural students, because so many of these areas are served specifically by North Idaho College. There are dual credit programs, trade schools. This isn't just some higher ed where you can get a philosophy major. I mean, the trade schooling on that campus alone is some of the best in the Northwest. And so when people look at these elections, this isn't just some politician. This isn't just some kind of race that doesn't have a massive impact. These elections could be the complete loss of education for your children. It could be your 18-year-old now moving out of state instead of staying in state to go to school. It could be your child not being able to afford to go to school because there's no affordable local option for them. And what you guys did was phenomenal. And I'm curious about if you had any techniques that were successful in trying to get new people involved and trying to identify people who wanted to step up, or if the extremists kind of did that for you.
A little bit of both. When extremism starts to grab hold of your community, people start to pay attention and they say, whoa, I don't like that. You know, this isn't the civic engagement that I learned about in fifth grade and sixth grade and seventh grade. Who are these people and why do they think they can tell me that their religion should be part of the policy at this public entity, right? So they helped, right? They got people's attention because we said, what's going on over here? We don't like this. But also when you get candidates on board, they bring their tribe with them as well. And that was really, really helpful. When you find great candidates who are really tied into the tapestry of a community, people stand up for them and people speak up for them. It's everything from, you know, individuals coming to every single meeting and figuring out how a text messaging system works, and they just jump full in. Now they're the head of like volunteers, to somebody who says, you know what, you can use my picture and I'll write a quick quote for a testimony supporting you. Or I'm going to take my family to the polls with me so they understand how important this election is. You know, it kind of, once again, bookends, because people care. And we found candidates that were so supported in this community that that they brought their tribe with them.
And I think you highlight such an important part of what I hear in our political discussions, which is it really, so many people are just talking about party. It's Democrats or it's Republicans or it's independent. But what I'm learning is every single candidate is so unique, and each of these individuals has really their own story to tell. So when I go to North Idaho and I look at these local candidates, specifically ones that I know for a fact you brought in or people in your camp brought in, they're teachers, they're community leaders, they're the kind of people that have made an impact on their community for decades.
I do want to,
and then I look at people.
Sorry. Oh, I want to say that when you say my camp, I would say that in this case, my camp is just average, ordinary, everyday people who want to make sure that that our institutions have integrity. You know, they're just like you said, there's no partisan component here. And I just want to highlight that one more time, because it's just community members that care.
That's all it is. Unlikely freedom fighters. They really are just kind of the people going about their day who all of a sudden saw something horrible happening in their communities and really saw a need for somebody to step up. And it's just been fascinating kind of watching the outside perspective on politics versus the inside. And I think if I could tell anybody anything, it would be to research local candidates. It would be to really look at who they are, what they've done, what their roles in communities have been, and then go to the polls and vote. Because the party has very little. And I mean, it does actually have quite a bit with a lot of policy stances, but it doesn't tell you anything about a candidate. So I'm curious, if you could have a direct link into every household in America, if you could have your own fireside chat, real quick, what would you want the American people to know, or people in this state, or rural progressives? What do you want them to know?
It's such a good question. And I would go with the cliche that is so true. All politics are local. The people that are making decisions about how often your street gets cleaned or gets cleared of snow, all the way up to how you're funding your libraries and the building code for buildings that are built in the county. All of that is decided at the local level. And all of that has a massive impact on how much your house is worth, on whether or not you want your kids to go to public schools, on whether or not you're gonna have to replace your tires because you keep hitting that pothole on the way to work. All politics is local. The hard thing is that, you know, when you're thinking about your city council and your county commissioners and your school board, right? It's all of these people who don't maybe have like a big online presence, or you don't quite know what's going to be on your next ballot. So it's really hard to sift through all those pieces. So I recognize that it's difficult, but it's worth the investment, because not a lot of people vote in local elections, but they make every difference in your everyday life.
Absolutely. And then they go to actually make up the party in your state. And so a lot of times local elections really do reflect. Okay, last thing before we throw it over, because I know that across America, Idaho is not alone. There are so many rural areas really facing kind of these far right operatives and these kind of extreme elements coming into their local politics. Do you have any words of advice, even if it's just drink more margaritas? Like, what is your advice to communities that are facing this real threat?
I was a college cheerleader. I am ready for this pep rally. My advice is to learn a skill that has to do with a campaign and go be the best at it. If you are an English major or you loved writing papers in high school, help people write their press releases. That's so hard to pull that cognitive power together when you're also, you know, doing all these other engagements as a candidate. If you know, if you love being on your device, setting up text messages to send out for candidates is so easy, and it is obsessively fun. So learn that skill and go implement that skill. If you're part of, you know, local networks, start talking about local politics to your colleagues and friends so that they can start getting interested in understanding the difference between candidates. You don't have to bring everything to the table. It sounds so overwhelming when somebody says, hey, will you help me with this campaign? Doesn't mean you have to knock on doors, even though it's really fun and you should. But if you have a skill, even if it's, you know, that you have an hour after work every day that you can go put signs in predetermined yards, offer up that skill. Another thing that we don't think about very much is people that run for office tend to have families. And I can tell you, Kaylee, that the difference between my front yard when I'm running for office and I'm not running for office is night and day. My front yard does not get raked in election years in the fall. And it's just hilarious to me because my neighbors know. So it's little things like that too. I'm not asking for somebody to come over and rake my yard, but for those of you out there listening that say, what can I do? Go watch somebody's kid who does want to knock on doors. You know, you can be part of that ecosystem that makes campaigns happen. You don't have to run the whole campaign, but you can be a part of it.
I absolutely love that. I like to say, get creative. It can literally be a party.
Yes.
It could actually be, if you wanted to just have your girlfriends over for drinks while you write funny postcards to your community on the issues that matter, make it creative, make it fun. It's really just getting together and doing something to impact your community. I am so grateful for you, Teresa. I am going to throw it over to Bijan because we have some really fun trivia for tonight.
Great.
We do. We do, Teresa. Gosh, what a story. And thank you so much for your kind words. I'm sure many listeners out there are really going to appreciate that. And, you know, it's spoken from your experience. However, I do want to pick up on one thing you mentioned. You mentioned, you know, having a margarita. Well, you're probably going to want to have one for this next game. This next game that we're going to be playing is called Time Warped, okay? And so the rules of the game are essentially this, right? I've got a series of quotes that were said throughout history, either in modern times or could have been as a religious zealot back in the 1700s. But what I want, I'm going to read the quotes, and what I want for you both to do is to guess whether or not this was modern MAGA or old school MAGA. So we've got a bunch of quotes, so buckle up. I hope you have your margarita ready because... I feel like I need to have one next to me. But we're going to jump right in, okay? So brace yourself. The first one is, the husband cannot be guilty of rape committed by himself upon his lawful wife for by their mutual matrimonial consent.
Well, that's atrocious. I mean, yeah. It sounds like something that a MAGA extremist could say. I'm going to throw it into the 1700s, though, with this hope.
Okay. Kelly, what do you say?
I wish it was from the 1700s, and the language kind of makes me hope that it's 1700s, but I'm also pretty sure I heard an Idaho lawmaker say that like 6 months ago, so I'm a little nervous on this one.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm curious to see what happens.
Oh, my goodness. Well, if it did, I mean, somebody out there, if that actually did happen, please clip that because I think Idaho has needed to sort of see that. No, it was said by Sir Matthew Hale in the 17th century. So that is old school MAGA, old school MAGA. Really unfamiliar with him and his, really unfamiliar with him and his body of work. But Sir Matthew Hale, yikes. Moving on to our second one. The quote is, I would hope that when a woman goes into a physician with a rape issue, that physician will indeed ask her about perhaps her marriage. Was this pregnancy caused by no more relations than a marriage? Or was it truly caused by a rape? I had a hard time even just sort of getting that segment out. Modern MAGA or old school MAGA?
You go first this time, Kaylee.
I know this is modern MAGA. I actually remember when they said this, and it was horrifying. And the worst part is that some of our North Idaho senators actually believe the same thing. So I'm going to, maybe I'm wrong, so we'll see what Teresa thinks.
I'm going to throw it to the 1700s. For that same reason before, I'm this eternal optimist. I really hope that this is passes by, but I'm also a realist. And I think you're right, Kaylee.
Oh my God. This is hard for me to get out. That was actually said by an Idaho Senator, Chuck Winder, 2012. That's in public.
Nailed it.
Inside of the public record. Hard to believe.
Okay. I feel like everyone listening to this podcast needs to know that Chuck Winder actually just said in an interview with the Idaho Statesman that the reason we need to stop the genocide of pro-choice abortions is because we have murdered 60 million preborn children, and that's why we can't find a workforce to work in our service industry. He said, Idaho desperately needs to get rid of the genocide of abortion because we need service workers. So, and that was about 2 weeks ago. Horrifying.
Wow. A margarita sounds wonderful right now for those having a drink and listening to this.
I'll take two.
Yep, that's right. That's right. Okay, let's move on. This next one is, America is a gift from God, preserved only by heroes who dare to fight and protect it as their own. Modern MAGA, old school MAGA.
Teresa, I'm going to let you take this one first.
Sounds good. I mean, it definitely reeks of nationalism. And that is something I see in my community every day. So I'm going to say that's modern.
Hmm. Kelly, what do you think?
I'm gonna say modern, but I feel like it might be a ripoff. It might be one of those things that John Adams said once, and then it just kind of gets repeated and handed down century after century.
Oh my God. You know, let me just jump on this real quick. As much as I hate to sort of platform somebody like this, this was actually modern. Modern. This is said by Charlie Kirk, founder of Turning Point USA, in 2020. So at the height of the pandemic, you've got people going around the country sort of saying this stuff, you know, in a time when people are terminally online, especially in, around the sort of depths of the pandemic, when things were really unclear. You know, I'm sure there's a study out there where you can see spikes in sort of nationalistic language, and sort of people starting to veer to the right, I think is really when it started to get really bad, particularly in online spaces. So yeah, give it up to Charlie Kirk for some of that wisdom.
And ironically, Charlie Kirk was in Coeur d'Alene during that same time with the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee as their featured speaker.
Wow. Love well, it. Maybe it's, I mean, I wonder if that actually, that quote was from that meeting. It could have been. There's a whole collection. Yeah, there's a whole collection of him saying stuff like that. So far be it for me and us to want to platform Charlie Kirk. Okay, one more and then we'll move on. One more and we'll move on. This one is, oh boy, this is interesting and also hard to get out. Suffrage is not a right. It is a privilege that may or may not be granted. Politics is no place for a woman. Oh, this is really hard to say. Politics is no place for a woman. Consequently, the privilege should not be granted. The privilege should not be granted to her. The mother's influence is needed in the home. Yikes.
First, I want to say that we're going to cut this and then put that online, and my campaign manager is going to be saying the most horrific things.
That would be ever. Terrible.
It would be Moby terrible. John, let's not do that.
Well, I have to say about
but
this.
But also, I'm going to take...
I have to say about this one. We had a local gentleman run for office, and gentleman might be too kind of a word for him, who was supported by the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee, ran for school board in my district, and he said not this exact thing, but he said that women should not have the right to vote. So I'm going to unfortunately put this modern because I have a neighbor that says this, and he ran for office and was supported by the local Republicans.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is devastatingly not surprising. I was going to ask if it was my opponent, Russ Fulcher, but I'm going to go ahead and just guess modern day MAGA.
Oh boy, we have lots of clips that we could generate from that. Yeah, and you know, if he had said something like that, I would have been the first one on it. But no, unfortunately not. You know, the funny thing about these types of people and this line of thinking is that it really doesn't change over time. The words just change, but the sentiment remains the same. This is old school magazine by a gentleman named, but even that might be, you know, too high praise to quote you, Teresa, J.B. Sanford. This is from 1911. It's arguing against the Eighth Amendment in the Constitution. Hard to believe. Well,
glad those ladies and men stood up for women's suffrage, and it is the law of the land.
Yeah, you had better believe it. There's many people that have fought hard to make sure that was constitutionally enshrined. And And it just goes to show that bigotry, there's no statute of limitations on bigotry whatsoever, and ignorance. So old school MAGA, there you go. Where is my margarita? Because I feel like after that, I sort of need to wash off.
Well, let me make it worse for you, because I just want to remind our listeners that there actually is still no Equal Rights Amendment. One of my favorite quotes in the world is Abigail Adams sent a letter to her husband while they were in Constitutional Convention, literally, and it starts, "Remember the ladies," basically asking them to put women in the Constitution. And we're 200 years later, and we have the right to vote, but we still actually do not have constitutional equal rights. So for everyone listening, please go check out the Equal Rights.
Okay, so I don't know where we left off, Teresa, but we're gonna keep it going. Look, we're just getting the hot takes here on Unlikely Freedom Fighters. But this is part of it. You know, part of this podcast is to make sure that we're encouraging folks to engage with the content. There's so many folks out there that have expressed to us and Kaylee a number of times, they just don't feel like they have a voice, right? And a lot of people, I think, are feeling like they're on an island. So the more folks that we have engaging with this content and this podcast, the better. We want to be able to create a community across the country of folks who are going through the same thing you described in your interview earlier. I believe it is hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people out there that feel the same way that you do, sort of turned off by the national discourse of the moment. However, look, here on the podcast, we are open, honest, transparent, and we will take the feedback in any way that it comes. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to read some wonderful comments sent in by our listeners, and I would let's talk about it. Let's talk about it, because I think that's how we sort of improve and we get better. Okay, the first one that I want to talk about, and this is sort of going back to something that you had said earlier in the interview, Teresa, and that you and Kaylee, I think, touched on really well. You know, the first one is from, what is one of my favorite names online, Swimming Zebra, 1189. Progressives in the state are obsolete. This state doesn't need bills passed that restrict farmers, union workers, and other people that actually provide it for this country. Go back to California and don't bring it with you. Oh boy, where do we start?
Kaylee, how many generations back do we have to go to get your family in California?
It's so funny, because when I talk about being a sixth generation Idahoan, I get a lot of slack, especially because of our indigenous communities. But I only say it in response to the people who tell me to go back to where I came from. Like, literally, I've grown up. This is all I've known. I can't tell you how much my family talk about the value of undeveloped land, of having cattle graze. I mean, my great-grandfather, Homer, who was the namesake of the street I live on, his big thing was he invented a way to get more bales of hay during the war while they didn't have the labor that they needed. So, like, this land and that lifestyle is my history, and it's so important. And then I get, go back to where you came from. At the Eagle Parade this 4th of July, I had my kids with me, and people were throwing the candy back at us and telling us to go back to where we came from. They were stomping it on the ground. They were booing at us. And this is with my 6 and 11-year-old. So, this comment, I would love to hear your take, because I know you have one on this kind of comment.
I absolutely do. So the thing here that is just so ironic, last legislative session, bathrooms were all the thing and gender was all the thing, to the point that the Idaho legislature were in the midst of creating a law that every single work site in the state of Idaho had to have a men's restroom and a women's restroom. And the construction lobby actually had to go toe-to-toe to say, look, that means that we're purchasing porta potties at every single site. That's going to drive up our costs. It's going to be insane. And the legislature just kept hitting on it and hitting on it and hitting on it. Their lobbyists really had to work hard to say, look, this isn't a problem in our industry. Back off. And finally, they left a caveat for construction workers in that law. So it's not about progressives that are trying to create additional hardships for workers. My experience is that we have tried to create safe work environments, right? If it wasn't for unions, we wouldn't have a 5-day work week. We would have a 7-day work week. Unions are the bread and butter of this nation. And I promise you, unions want goodness for themselves as well. They don't want to have overregulation. And once again, that's why unions had to get involved with those conversations to say, hey, don't tell us how to use the bathroom on the work site. That was the conservatives.
Well, that's when we go into rural communities, it's fascinating seeing a comment like this, because my entire platform is labor. It is literally my entire platform is making the government work for working class peoples. That means I work with the steel workers, the iron workers, the electrical workers, the teachers, the farmers. And I see all of these problems that people deal with on a daily basis. And none of our elected officials, especially across the aisle, are dealing with any of them. And so then we look in and we say, okay, how do we make sure that the farm bill provides enough food sustenance for our farming families? How do we make sure that they have the labor that they need? How do we make sure that they're not being worked overtime with very little pay and no benefits? How do we make sure that these corporations and out-of-state interests aren't coming in, using up our communities, and then leaving? So to see a comment like this, I just want to tell people, look at us more closely. Like, go read about your candidates. Look at what we actually stand for and the work we're doing. Because as a progressive, he basically just outlined my entire platform.
And that was a service. Thank you, Swimming Zebra.
Thank you.
Thank you, Zebra. We appreciate you, man, for platforming and drawing attention to the hard work that Kaylee's doing. That and also the hard work of folks across the state, because it's certainly not easy. Now, this next one that I think is also interesting, and it sort of gets to the point that, like I had said earlier in opening the segment, which is that, you know, part of the point of this podcast is to connect to more folks that are in Idaho now, that sort of share your story, Teresa, that share the story of millions of others, tens of thousands of others. But it's also like bigger than that too. The point is that we have the ability to sort of connect communities across this country that are sort of dealing with, you know, regardless if you're in Oregon, if you're in Maine, if you're in Missouri, if you're in Louisiana, if you're in Idaho, I think there's a lot of people out there that are sort of experiencing the same thing. So this comment comes from, I don't know where people come up with these names, but gosh, again, this is just incredible. Wet Burbs 20. I don't know which one's better. I mean, I'm inclined to say that Wet Burbs is a better name than Swimming Zebra, but I don't know. Their comment's interesting. It says, this, in parentheses, the podcast is for progressives in Idaho, but you interviewed someone from Missouri. Make that make sense. You should platform Idaho progressives. And I'm just curious to hear what your take is on that.
I want to jump in on this one. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, take it away, Katie.
I want to jump, because this is exactly why we created this podcast. Because when I looked at what was happening here in Idaho, I was able to then go to Missouri and work with rural candidates there who were seeing almost the exact same thing. And we worked nationally and we saw all of these rural districts experiencing the same thing, but who were getting left behind. They weren't getting support from the party. They weren't getting national press or attention. And so while this podcast is, I'm an Idaho progressive and a rural progressive, it's meant to reach the national audience of people who are in communities like ours dealing with issues like ours. And so I want to highlight incredible people like Teresa. But I also want to know, like, I want every other state to know that they're not in this alone, that we are kind of banded together by this trauma bonding.
We absolutely are. And when Jess talks about being a dirt road Democrat, I have to go down some serious dirt roads to get to the voters in my district as well. So it's nice to have somebody who's kind of, you know, walked that road before, literally and figuratively, and can help you out. You don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And we certainly have time. I mean, this project is going to continue to expand. We want more folks to come inside the tent. We want more folks from all across this country. And when we're speaking with folks that are in Idaho, look, I mean, like, the whole conversation could be about what's happening in your backyard, what's happening in the state. But it's also important, I think, to share the stories of others across the country, just to echo what you both have been saying. Teresa, I'm going to give you one more, and I want your first take on this, because this is, you know, given some of your background, we did have somebody, I actually don't know how to say this, so I'm going to take a stab at it. AMEC? KSZT, really cool name. I'm sure it means something. But they responded to the podcast saying, the facilities / buildings in many school districts, I'm assuming again in parentheses in Idaho, are in need of major repair or replacement. This has had a negative impact on learning, and teachers are human, and some are better than others. How does it, I mean, what do we make of that?
Well, it's true, right? If we are sending students to school in classrooms where there's buckets on the ground to catch the snow melt because the roofs are failing, that's a problem. And that actually happens all over the state. You know, we do get some resources from the Idaho Lottery. They have a building improvement fund, but that is not nearly enough money throughout the state to keep our buildings safe and to keep them in places that are conducive to learning. You know, in North Idaho, specifically in Bonner County, they have had a hard time, Boundary County, it's Bonner's Ferry. They've had a hard time passing school improvement levies to be able to keep their schools safe enough to have students in them, to the point that they've had to declare an emergency to the state legislature, to the governor, and say, what do we do? We've tried over and over and over again to pass these levies, and our voters won't say yes, but our schools are completely dilapidated. What do you want us to do next? And there isn't a good answer for it because of the way that we've set up the system to pay for school improvements and to fund local education. So there's not a great solution here, unfortunately, under our current rules. And that's why you need to pay attention to who you put on school boards and how you talk to your neighbors about their school levies and who you elect to state offices to represent you. And because that's where the laws get made about how funding works. And if we're not funding our schools, if we're not keeping them in good enough shape to not be condemned, that shouldn't be a big ask, then we're not doing our students a good service.
I hear this a lot. I hear kind of this demonization of federal funding a lot, or honestly, a demonization of any state funding at all. And people are upset and they don't want their taxes to increase. And I tell them, then ask the state to properly fund education. Your property taxes should not be solely responsible for whether or not your children have a good education. Idaho's constitution specifically requires a quality public education for every single Idahoan. And so I try and talk to people, but there has been this kind of dark cloud put over receiving federal funding. And I want to remind people, they pay their taxes. Americans pay taxes in every possible way, before you get the paycheck, after you get the paycheck, while you're at the stores, while you're at the pumps. So those tax dollars should be going right back into your community. They should be making sure that we not just have non-dilapidated schools. I want the best schools. When we talk about being the greatest country on the earth, to me, that means making sure our children have the greatest education opportunities, and that requires funding. And so it's been interesting to see kind of especially Idaho legislators try and turn funding into a bad thing and try and say that we're throwing good money after bad. But it was really interesting to me that the best schools in the country were actually government-run schools, but they were funded by the Department of Defense because they were on military camps. So it just goes to show public schools can be the best if they have the funding that, you know, like our military industrial complex does.
I mean, it's a great point. You know, I think, you know, we're going to go ahead and round out the seven, but I guess the point is for, you know, our listeners, like these comments are great to hear. We encourage that feedback. You know, we want to make sure that this content is valuable and that you're getting something out of it. And honestly, the more engagement that we get and we hear from you, the better this podcast is going to be. So we encourage you, you know, regardless of what your username is, where you're located, we want you to engage. We want to hear your thoughts. So please, in the comments, in email, however you choose to reach us, we do read them. So please do it. Don't hold back. We are happy to, despite what some may think, we are happy to read your comments. So please do. Seriously, in all seriousness, please do.
All right. And please, I love the criticisms, especially as a debater. So I love hearing what people have said. But I want to, as we wrap up, I just want to kind of end on this note, which is, Teresa, are you listening or reading or kind of do you have any recommendations for what puts your mind at ease or what you've been enjoying lately?
You know, I just read a book called True West, and it was by an author named Betsy Gaines Plowman. And it's a book about the myths we tell ourselves in the West about endless resources or about absolute freedoms that we have. And it really broke down narratives that are really recent, including an expose on the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee of all things. And it was the most fascinating read because it really matters. It matters what what myths we tell ourselves and what we believe about the spaces that we live in. If we believe this is the Wild West, you know, where there are no laws and we can do whatever we want, well, they're going to have one kind of society. But if we, you know, all come here with shared values of loving the outdoors and protecting our resources, we're going to have a different society. So True West, fantastic book. Like I said, very specific, hyper-local in one segment to North Idaho, but it's about the West in general. Really fantastic.
I haven't heard about that, but that's going to be my recommendation too, because I need to go rent it immediately and read it. Bijan, do you have any good recommendations before we head out?
You know, well, that's an interesting one and super cool. You know, I mean, True West, you know, I grew up in Maine, as I said at the top of the podcast. We have our own sort of sense of our identity. I'd be curious, now that you've inspired me to go, I'm sure there's authors out there who have written what it's like to grow up in Maine. And you've got me sort of thinking, it's interesting. And then how do we sort of change those myths, or how do we address them, or create sort of new narratives around our experience? Yeah, okay, I'll go buy that book now. I have two that are really interesting. One is Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain, written a long time ago. I happen to love Anthony Bourdain, and there's a lot of lessons that you can take from head chef inside of a number of restaurants in New York and on the Cape in Massachusetts. I just sort of love his approach and sort of grittiness and focus on management in a chaotic environment and being, you know, sort of true to yourself. So there's a lot of stuff that they get into in the book, but I think one of the themes for me is that, you know, out of chaos, you can have sort of a controlled approach and how important that is. So that's the first thing. Second one is 48 Laws of Power. That is, you know, a classic. It's an essential book if you're a business or just somebody who's sort of navigating, you know, the world of politics or corporate America, or maybe your first job. It's just sort of a good sort of, how do I understand, you know, interpersonal relationships and how do I understand sort of how to get my point across to people and how decisions are made? It's just a good one to understand. It's a little bit nerdy, but that's kind of who I am. So those are my two.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, Teresa, please let our listeners know, especially as a local candidate, where can they find you? Where can they learn more about you? Do you have anything coming up that you want them to paying attention to? Please let our listeners know where to find you.
Thanks so much, Kaylee. So finding me on Facebook is probably the best right now. I haven't officially launched my campaign for this upcoming session or cycle. So I don't have everything live at the moment, but we will be there shortly. So we'll get there.
Amazing. Perfect. And for everybody listening, you can find us at KayleeForCongress.com or at KayleeForCongress on any social media. Or I shouldn't say that. I assume it's all the socials, but I don't actually know. Facebook, Twitter, Threads, TikTok, Insta. I think those are all of them. But if our listeners could go check it out, we just launched an infrastructure survey for Idaho's First District. We're trying to identify issues in the First District that aren't properly being funded right now. So if you have an issue inside Idaho's First District, please go online, check that out, send us an email, because we want to hear about it and identify funding for you. All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for listening. Special thanks once again to one of my favorite people in the world, Dr. Teresa Boren-Paul. And as always, I want everybody to remember to thrive, survive, and don't be scared to organize. That's us signing off for the day.
Unlikely Freedom Fighters is a bi-weekly podcast written and produced by Lucas Longacre and edited by associate producer Nick Sproul. Our title track, We Go Again, is by Joseph. Have any questions or comments? You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Unlikely Fighter, or on Facebook at Unlikely Freedom Fighters. And finally, in the words of Jimmy Carter, the best way to enhance freedom in other lands is to demonstrate here that our democratic system is worthy of emulation.